Prepare to be astonished!
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
And good evening. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital here tonight with Mac Burns, Clatsop County Historical Society. Welcome to an adventure in history.
And we're ganging up on you.
We are. Because finally. Finally.
One member. Oh, there goes my ride. Because one member of the Historical Society is not enough.
Right. We needed more than one.
We have our curator. Yes. Chelsea Vaughn is here.
Hello, good evening.
Welcome.
You are a two-time guest now.
I am, that's true. Yes, I spoke maybe 2 years ago on the station about medical care.
That's right, it was about the medical exhibit.
Right, yeah.
So we only invite you when we have exhibits. That seems rude.
Well, it kind of makes some sort of sense since I am responsible for assembling the exhibits.
One more time and you get a t-shirt.
Right,
that's
good.
Right.
That we talk about and we actually never give out.
Someday.
Okay. Yes.
Someday.
We do talk about it.
We'll work on a t-shirt someday. Yeah.
Fingers welcome to the best show ever.
Well, thank you.
This is going to be the best show ever.
It is.
And speaking of best shows ever, there are a lot of great shows.
Yes.
On this wonderful radio station.
There are. We love our local public radio station.
Is it free, though?
It's not free.
It is free, but it doesn't cost free. There's
true.
A cost to putting this show
yes,
on and all
priceless.
The other wonderful shows. But for the vast listening audience, it's free.
It is. Yep. And it's definitely a great public service. But you can get involved by becoming a donor today, this evening, online.
Online. I can just go to their website?
You can.
Coast what is Radio, that website?
CoastRadio.org.
I threw you off.
I thought
you had it poised and ready.
CoastRadio.org.
See, this is why we should do this video
stream,
because your eyes got very big. Although, do people's eyes just get bigger because there's masks on and we notice it more?
That could.
Possibly, yeah.
I think so.
I try to use my eyebrows a lot, like smiling with my eyebrows. Can you see it?
Okay.
Through the radio.
So just a half hour. So this show right now is costing KMUN, let's see, let's just call it an hour. Two shows, $62.50. That's it.
Yep.
So everybody listening to our voices now should send $62.50.
And they have great staff. I mean, this is a quality staff, very professional, and it takes very few of them because they are really honing in on all of their talent and strengths to put out the shows and programming that you can listen to today and listen to on podcasts. They have great podcasts.
They do. It's a well-oiled machine.
It is.
And you can keep it well-oiled by sending $62.50.
So that we can do two more shows.
That's right.
Yes.
Because they might throw us off the air if we don't raise that amount of money.
Ooh. Didn't know that.
Maybe. They haven't threatened us, but maybe. Okay. Shall we move on with the big show?
We should.
We got a lot of serious stuff to talk about.
But first. This day in history.
This day in history. Oh, I thought you had something first.
No.
You were very dramatic there. Okay, so this is for things tomorrow, so you can appear smart at the water cooler or at the coffee shop or wherever you may be.
Zoom.
Or on Zoom, or if you're suddenly on Jeopardy tomorrow. So April 12th, things that happened on this day. 1892, the portable typewriter is patented by George C., and I love this guy's name, Blickensderfer. It's like he's trying to use every letter on the typewriter.
That is a good one.
Yeah, I like his name. 1945. Sad FDR dies.
Yes.
You know, I'm a big fan. 1954. Bill Haley and the Comets record Rock Around the Clock.
I saw that one. That's a good one.
I like Bill Haley.
Yeah.
Although sometimes it's Bill Haley and his Comets.
Oh.
Then sometimes it's Bill Haley and the Comets.
Yeah.
And I'm confused by that. Okay, 1961, because you know I love the space stuff. And this, I feel badly, that more people should celebrate this. Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin becomes the first man in space.
Oh, cool.
Okay, I hate the Russians beat us. If it's a competition, I want us to win, but he's the first guy in space. Why don't we all know the name?
Right.
I feel badly for poor Yuri. 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. is jailed and writes the letter from a Birmingham jail.
Oh, right. Good.
Pretty powerful stuff. 1981, the space shuttle Columbia is launched for the first time, becoming the first reusable manned spacecraft. I like that we can reuse spacecraft.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sad that we don't do that anymore. We should get back to that. But the history highlight of the day thing I think had the most impact on history, 1861, the Civil War begins as Confederate forces fire on Fort Sumner, South Carolina's Charleston Bay. Civil War.
All right.
Can't argue with that. So since we have a much better historian here with me.
Yes.
Am I right in picking that one?
Picking the Civil War as the
is
the most important, probably for maybe not for Russia. Russians might pick a different historical moment,
but it was still significant to them too.
that case could be made.
Yeah. Yes.
So I guess we're never going to have the show air in Russia now.
Well, it can't. Well, I think it can in some places. I mean, on podcasts, right?
They probably could. Yes. Yeah. So maybe there are some Russian people taking issue right now. With
probably.
Me.
You probably. Yeah. Okay. Started a feud there.
Yeah, I'm just glad that we just had an international incident.
Exactly.
I'm just glad you didn't say the typewriter. The portable typewriter.
You know, I was thinking when you were saying his last name, not that he was trying to use every letter, but that sounded like when you smash all the keys down and it jams up. I was just imagining that, and that's how his name was made.
Blickensderfer.
Yeah.
See, when you started saying that, I was wondering if they were all on the same line or something. Yeah. I had to kind of go back to typing class and picture where my fingers are.
I just remember being a kid at my grandma's typewriter and just smashing them all.
Yes.
Yeah, getting all jammed up.
So, Chelsea Vaughn, you are the curator of the Clatsop County Historical Society. So how does one become the curator?
Well,
what is your background?
My background in particular, I did graduate studies at the University of California at Riverside. I actually got a PhD there. Not all curators necessarily have PhDs, but that is something, you know, my specialty was in museum work. So I had some experience there. I learned, you know, the various skills of, you know, both object management, but then also you have to learn sort of the theories of interpretation and audience interaction. So it's a relatively wide-ranging bit of graduate work there, both, you know, practical and theoretical.
So that's interesting. We're going to geek out here, and Alana can bring us back down to earth.
Yeah, I know. That's okay.
But is it harder to write for a museum audience and research for a museum audience or for a classroom full of students at the college level? Or I'm going to publish a scholarly book?
You know, everything I write for the museum, I run by our archivist, I run by a few other staff members, and they ding me for big words all the time. All the time they're like, who's your audience? But I also am a fan of actually having some big words in there, right? Making people, not talking down to people. I don't think you need to. I think people can figure things out if they don't know something. And it's a good way to expose people. Honestly, it's easier to write for a museum than when preparing, say, a lecture for college students, because you can trust, I don't want to say that college students don't know big words, but certainly sometimes those ones seem a little bit tapped out. You know, people choose to go to a museum.
Yes.
People take history classes at college oftentimes because it's a requirement. So it's not always the same engagement. And to be fair, I mean, I was a history student. I loved history, but when I was teaching college history, I was largely teaching it as a survey course requirement. Mm-hmm. So I find doing, you know, museum text panels much more engaging. And also I get to do different things all the time, right? So when you're teaching a history class, you're teaching the same class every 10 weeks.
Gotcha.
Or, you know, whereas this, I'm looking into and learning about new odd things all the time. And so I enjoy that component of it as well.
So something new for me. And the exhibit is now open, so we've been welcoming visitors for more than a few days now.
Right.
This temporary exhibit, and you heard us talk about it last week, Away From Home, Native American Indian Boarding School Stories.
Right.
It's a traveling exhibit. I didn't know much about this. I mean, I knew kind of the basics that for some period of time, the American government made a very concerted effort to destroy Native American culture. And the way to do that, besides have a war and practice genocide, is also to put them on reservations and then take their children and try and eliminate that culture by let's cut their hair, let's make them change their religion, not speak their native language, not wear their traditional clothing,
right,
and teach them some menial jobs or skills that maybe they'll change into those instead of going back and practicing the traditional lifestyles. But I didn't know much more than that. So talk a little bit about this exhibit.
Well, this is a great exhibit. It's based upon an exhibit started 20 years ago now by the Heard Museum in Arizona. And it really, the thing I like about it is this is a very difficult history, right? As you're pointing out, Mac, this is an attempt to create a generational break and basically a cultural genocide. You know, the famous line by Pratt, who is the first, who founds Carlisle in Pennsylvania, is, you know, kill the Indian, save the man. That meaning that the only way to have Native Americans survive into the contemporary era is to completely remove their culture and traditions, which is, of course, a very unfortunate and tragic stance. The thing about the schools, so they start in the late 1800s, originally.
Kind of the 1870s when the Indian Wars, so-called Indian Wars, are winding down.
The end of the so-called Indian Wars. You have the first one is Carlisle in Pennsylvania. Fun fact, the second one is just 60 miles from here in Forest Grove. It was in operation for about 5 years before being moved down to Salem and becoming Shemawa.
Shemawa.
So, and Shemawa is the oldest operational Indian boarding school in the country. The purpose of these schools has changed dramatically over that time period. Initially, again, they were designed to basically kidnap children, make them denounce their culture and families, and make it so they could not actually easily return home. Then, over the years, through a variety of things, these schools have evolved, and so that today, oftentimes, they are now all actually run by, they're all Native run. They actually serve a significant role within Native American communities now. That transition didn't happen overnight, and just today, we were talking to a gentleman, actually, who came to see the exhibit, describing working at Shemawa in the 1960s, and he still described it as relatively regimented and, directed towards teaching kids, more vocational skills and more things of that nature.
So the schools evolved, but was there a turning point that maybe we're not trying to eradicate their culture, but maybe now we're actually trying to raise them up and celebrate their culture?
And there were multiple turning points. You look back as early as 1900, and the first real movement to actually sort of embrace Native American culture came through the form of arts and crafts. And that is very much tied to the arts and crafts movement, this idea of we are going to appreciate and reevaluate more traditional art forms. But that also, very interestingly, was really done not as a way for Native Americans to preserve their culture, as it was so that they could sell baskets to tourists and make some money. That was actually the thought pattern, was that people, that there's interest in these traditional handicrafts, we can have these students make them for a tourist market, and that's going to be where their income capabilities lie. So that's the first sort of shift you start to see towards embracing more, traditional Native American ways. And over time, you start seeing the students themselves are engaging it more. The forced, technically the, forcing students to attend these schools officially ends in the 19-teens, though certainly coercion and other methods continue beyond that. You have 1928, you have a scathing report about the conditions of these schools that causes them to sort of shift, had to, clean up their act, as it were. In the 1930s, you have the Indian New Deal, and as part of that, these schools, again, students start to be gaining more autonomy. These schools are seen more as a way of serving communities, though still it's not ideal. It's still emphasizing things like vocational training, things of that nature. And it's really not until, I think, more the later era, like 1970s, that you really start to see this transition where these are no longer, they are actually then taken over and managed by Native communities themselves.
Mm-hmm. So when you were setting up this exhibit, and you've seen a lot of exhibits as a curator, were there any images or any part of the exhibit that just made you pause as you were visualizing it, taking it in all by yourself?
There's so many powerful components of this exhibit. It's hard to identify just one, but I will say, there were some things I anticipated having a strong emotional response to. Like, for example, horribly, we have shackles for a child on display as part of this. We have a barbershop or sorry, barber chair with a clipped braid as part of the opening. So just to indicate, you know, how it's a clear sign of how, you know, the culture was removed so quickly. But then also the one thing that I was really surprised by that took me off guard is we have this tiny little mannequin in a tiny little suit. And I just went, like, I keep finding myself like kind of like adjusting his suit and like trying to make him, you know, fix it somehow. And it's just, I think just the sort of the visualization of like how very small these kids were when they were removed. And that sort of, that struck me, that was very striking for me.
And I think for any parent, as all three of us are, mm-hmm. I think you can't go through this exhibit without picturing your own child right. being taken away, mm-hmm. and maybe it's your child in that little costume or in those handcuffs, or just some of the stories. And there are some, I mean, they're still tragic, but there's also some somewhat amusing stories, like the kindergartners that you talked about trying to bust out the other kindergartners.
Right. And yeah, certainly. And since it's something like that is one of my favorite stories that comes along with this exhibit as an example. You know, a story, obviously, was not a happy or a fun event for these kids. You know, so there's some kindergartners put into school jail. The sheer existence of a school jail is itself just horrific. But then the other kindergartners made a battering ram from a log and they busted the door open and they busted their classmates out. So that's such a, I think that story, you know, it's obviously this was probably very traumatic for these children. But I think it's also very powerful because it speaks to their desire to not conform to this horrible thing that has been put upon them and their desire to, you know, resist and to stand together and to stay together. And so I think that's one thing that's really powerful about this exhibit, because obviously this is a very terrible, traumatic history, but it's also a history in which people survived, they persevered, they held on to their culture despite the best efforts to have their culture be completely destroyed by outside sources.
Yeah, it wasn't successful, ultimately. As much as they tried, these kids kept their culture.
Right.
And did not let it be totally destroyed. You know, the story of the kindergartners, actually, I've been chatting with some visitors as they go through, as they leave, just right. to kind of feel them out of how do they like this? What do they think? And that story has been actually told to me a couple of times now, of one that really jumps out at people. Hmm. So it's amazing. And this doesn't, you know, some people have said, well, how does this affect Clatsop County? Or how does this affect Astoria? And this is a national story. This affects anywhere where there are Native American people. And right. and this is an American story that we're all a part of. And I think it resonates even today. The impacts of these schools continues to have a ripple effect across time.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the idea, again, that it's not a Native or not a local story or not local history, it's just not simply not correct. Like I was saying at the beginning here, the second Indian boarding school in the country was a mere 60 miles from here. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there is some information and interpretation of that within this exhibit. So it's you know, it's a local story in that it affects everyone, but it's also a local story in that we're within a physical proximity of one of the first schools. You know, this has definitely affected people locally, yeah. and you know, probably continues to affect people locally, because as I've heard from people whose families have gone through this, this affects, you know, this has created a generational break. This has affected not just the people who were sent to schools, but it affected their families for that loss. It affected, you know, how they interacted going forward. It affects their children and their grandchildren. It's not a one-time thing. It wasn't just that, like, you know, a generation of children were taken away and then that was it. That process was repeated and repeated and repeated. So it can't not have a profound effect on people.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know if we mentioned, but it's a traveling exhibit from the National Endowment for the Humanities,
right.
Put together by the Mid-America Arts Alliance out of Kansas City. Part of their mission is to make rural communities have access to great exhibits like this. And it was put together, you did say, by the Heard Museum in Arizona. And it's been booked. We booked it about 2 years ago. It's already booked 5 years out. And this is your opportunity to see it, because the closest it's coming is Boise, Idaho. The Idaho State Historical Society has it, I think, next year. Right. And then the Autry Museum of the West.
Yes, in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles has it, I think, either the end of 23 or in 24. And we already know of some family members, Sioux tribal members that are coming up from Los Angeles because this is they don't want to wait a couple of years and this is the closest it's going to be. So the exhibit's only here for 7 weeks. And it's an incredible opportunity, but shall we take a little break?
That sounds good. We'll be right back.
April 2nd, 1926. Clock-like regularity his reward. Kellogg, all brand relieved constipation of long standing. Don't let constipation drag you down, and don't become slave to habit-forming pills and drugs. Kellogg's all brand, eaten regularly, is guaranteed to relieve constipation or your money is returned, because it's 100% bran. Eat 2 tablespoons daily, in chronic cases, with every meal. Ready to eat, with milk or cream, use it in cooking, with the recipes given on the package. Kellogg's all brand is made by Kellogg in Battle Creek, Michigan. Sold by all grocers, served everywhere.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila. Welcome. We are talking about an exhibit that's here at the Clatsop County Historical Society, the Heritage Museum. And it's going to be on display for how long, Mac?
Through May 25th.
May 25th, yes.
And then we crate it up and send it off to Pennsylvania.
Right, exactly.
Where did those boxes go? Those boxes were gigantic.
You know, I almost, you saw them because you came in here. There are 20 giant crates, and I almost wanted to leave them out so people could see them. But the staff here, which I do have to just verbally say, it's not just Chelsea.
Right.
But there are other people, Matt Powers and some volunteers. They've done just amazing work. These boxes are heavy even when they're empty, and they're hidden in all kinds of nooks and crannies throughout the building at this point.
And they're not boxes, people. These are huge, large wooden crates.
Yes.
A couple of them I thought had bodies in them because they were kind of the right size to actually pile up a couple of bodies in there, but thankfully they were not.
But away from home. So this is a great event, exhibit to bring folks to. We've talked about this before. It's not for all ages.
It's not. And this is one thing I've been thinking about. And you know, one discussion we've been having is that the sheer fact that we get to decide whether or not we are exposing our children to these horrific events that happen to other children is it's a point of privilege, and we need to acknowledge that. But they recommended age is 13 and up. But what I would say is trust your kid. Right. And there's various ways to engage this history with kids. You know, we have some mid-reader books for sale in our store, which is a great way to have kids engaged in this history. We set up a activity station in a different gallery, which is, again, geared towards engaging children or not children. I would say upper elementary, lower middle school age kids with this history because it's such an important history that they should be told about it. But in general, you know, like I said, trust your kid, know your kid. Know if you think they could handle it. Mac has recommended possibly coming to see the exhibit first, and so you have an idea of what it is, and so you can, you know, have the discussions beforehand, have the discussions during, have the discussions after that are essential toward sharing this very important story.
Yeah, you know, I thought about it. I was like, okay, I want my kid to know about the Holocaust. But I'm not going to take a 5 or 6 year old through the Holocaust Museum and see a big giant pile of shoes and have to explain that. But I think teaching hatred and that people are picked on for different reasons and horrible things have happened is a valuable lesson that every child should know. But you know the context and seeing pictures and seeing child sized handcuffs and seeing the before and after photos of when a student was first brought to the school and then 3 years later when they've and I'm using air quotes here, been civilized, they're shocking.
Yeah,
I mean, my children are old enough that I don't have to worry about this, but, you know, if you've got little kids, like for you, Lana, I think you should go through it first before you would ever dream of bringing your child through.
Right, absolutely. And again, I said that there's multiple ways to engage kids, I think, with this history, and we did deliberately set up a separate you know, educational space for it. So that, you know, if you're worried that your child can't handle, you know, the very, very visual components of this, it's hard. It's hard as an adult looking at it. It breaks my heart.
I still have nightmares about the chitty chitty bang bang, the scary guy in that wagon that steals the children.
Yeah.
That still bothers me to this day.
Yeah, right.
And it's, that was just a movie.
Right. Where this is real life. Happened, and this really happened to real children. Yeah.
And so, people don't need to worry about crowds. This is all of your properties are very COVID safe. Attendance is limited and monitored. So people can feel very comfortable when they come here. Tell me a little bit about what they can expect when they come either to any of your museums.
Well, when they're coming to this museum, it's important to note that we actually, this is one of 7 exhibits we actually have here at the Heritage Museum. So we try to tell quite a few stories here. But coming to this museum, coming to this exhibit specifically, we do actually have a brochure, which is nice for this exhibit that helps kind of lead people into it. There is directionally a way to kind of move through it because it has a very clear sort of narrative arc to it, beginning with, the kids first arriving in the schools in the earliest days and, you know, just how very the terribleness of it and moving through to sort of how these schools transform over time. So going through these, it has these very large walls that were very interesting to assemble. And so you actually really can pretty easily separate yourself out from other people. Definitely, again, the Heritage Museum, people who haven't been here, City Hall. It's a rather large space. It's very easy to socially distance yourself in.
And we've got limited capacity because of COVID restrictions. We're at 50% capacity, which, you know, technically speaking, because this is a large building, our numbers are much larger than we would ever probably have of what we're allowed. So to have 50% capacity, you got to wear masks, of course. But it is, like Chelsea said, it's easy to kind of, there's a couple of people in this room. Maybe I'll go to the gallery across the hallway and come back to this one.
And there's plenty to see.
The elevator is probably the tightest spot. We ask only 2 people in there at a time. Right. So no worries there.
But we appreciate people's patience with that.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much. Any teasers on what comes next?
Well, so after this exhibit, we have a fun exhibit that didn't get much play because we were shut down for so much, called Signs of the Times, and also The Model City. It's a split exhibit. One half uses historic signs from around town to sort of explore the history of Astoria. The other one, we have a fantastic array of scale models of how people imagined Astoria's development. So on the other side, some of it's Astoria's history and some of it is how, you know, people imagining Astoria. And
for people that want the bypass.
Right.
We have a great example of what the bypass could have looked like and could look like.
Right. We have this amazing model of the highway, the Highway 30 bypass was proposed.
With no traffic, right?
Yes, you can enjoy it with no traffic.
There you go. Yeah. Well, that's great.
And no potholes.
Thank you so much for joining us, Chelsea. And thank you for helping bring this exhibit away from home to Clatsop County.
All right. And it's here through May 25th. So everybody should check it out. This time of year, the Heritage Museum is closed on Sundays and Mondays, but May 1st, it'll be open every day from 10 until 5. Right now it's 10 till 4.
Right.
And you don't need a reservation. Just come on out. If you're a member, you get in free.
Exactly.
So thank you. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.